Welcome to another interview, discussion, conversation with Mike Mason and myself from The Human Diver. And what we're going to talk about today is the double-edged sword of online narratives, online storytelling, and the bit where we sit there and go, you know what, let's share a story. It's really good. And then sometimes that story goes down a different rabbit hole that we weren't expecting. Now, that can be a positive, but it can also be a negative. And we'll also explore some of the barriers to learning. And even when somebody shares a story and feedback is provided, that sometimes that is not taken as it should be and create a learning opportunity, because we don't necessarily, or those who are involved don't necessarily have the humility to sit there and go, actually, that does apply to me, because we are hugely biased by a number of outcomes that are there. So, Mike, welcome. You're in Brisbane. I'm in Vancouver. We are, I think, 19 hours apart at the moment.
Give or take.
So, yeah, exactly. And we, you know, we both come from a military aviation background, and that ability to debrief critically, where we focus on the behaviors, the actions, and not the individuals. And there's a piece that I remember seeing of a Red Arrows debrief, and not necessarily as extreme in my own aviation background, but it was a case of you enter the debrief as a formation position, as a call sign, and it's not me as Gareth and Mike. It's Phantom 1 and Phantom 2. And it's like, well, the debrief is around about the role. So I know you teach in the Australian Air Force at the moment. How do you get that point across in terms of the debriefing? Because you're definitely in that performance development space.
I think fortunately, because of the way that we do things, it's a cultural norm and it's done right from day one. So the students come in to number one flying training school, where they're meeting these new instructors that have, they're on this pedestal of excellence that have been flying for years. And the instructors show them that from day one. You will do a formation, or you'll do a single aircraft sortie. So you've just got one instructor, one student, and the instructor will not necessarily say, Gareth, what were you thinking there? They'll just almost remove the names. It's like, what's going on here? What was your mental model, to make it about the something or an associate?
The pilot.
Behavior.
Yeah.
Yeah. Rather than someone. As you graduate beyond individual debriefs into formations, which we do an awful lot at where I teach, it becomes call signs, as you've already alluded to, Phantom 1, Phantom 2. But it's, we'll have a student sat in the front and an instructor sat in the back of, say, number two. And during the debrief, during the brief and the debrief, I'll be, number one, the formation lead. And I'll say, two Alpha, do you have any questions at the student? Two Bravo, do you have any fill-ins? And it's the same kind of dialogue at the end. And it just makes it, it's that really subtle reframing of how you're trying to ask questions or get feedback across, and it makes it about something or the role somebody had in a particular context. And it's a cultural norm. Everybody does it. Nobody, you don't even think about it after a while, and it does just make it so much more powerful in terms of a learning opportunity to take forward.
And that learning bit, when we come about the debriefs, often, you know, when I go and teach in the corporate space, in the non-aviation space, in the diving space, often when we have a debrief, it's like, well, what went wrong? Well, nothing went wrong. So why are we doing this debrief? And it's really this powerful piece that says, actually, you know, in our debrief framework within The Human Diver, of what went well and why, what do we need to improve and how are we going to do it? And even the thing that went wrong, we're reframing that as, what do you need to improve and how are you going to do it? And it's that bit about the why did it go well so we can replicate it, and how do we make that improvement? So what's your experience of, and we just had a discussion beforehand about how you reframe some of that positive stuff about what went well. Build on it. Go for it.
I guess something I'll just pick on to start with is that when we talk about something that went well, we're often referring to outcomes. And fortunately, when I go flying, it's very rare to have, like, let's call it a serious outcome. The aeroplanes don't crash into each other very often. They don't crash into the ground very often. And I mean, like, almost never. Like, it's really, really rare. However, we will come quite close to flying into each other, let's call it, relatively often. And there's a big left and right of arc there, and I don't want people to kind of take too much away, but it's just a part of what we do when we teach our combat tactics. But sometimes it happens in a manner where the mental models of those involved were different. to an extent where it became almost dangerous. And while you didn't have a bad outcome, I would argue that perhaps if that was in the commercial space, the non-high-risk industry worlds that people live in, yeah, they might just say, well, nothing went wrong, and therefore moving on. Fortunately, aviation has evolved over many years of near misses and real fatalities and accidents, such that if you do have one of these near misses, it's actually recognized. And it's like, well, yes, while we didn't fly into each other or didn't fly into the ground, the only reason we didn't is either potentially just luck or one final alert system
save,
just happened to
immediate
wake
save
us up.
yeah
an immediate save right at the last minute. Whoa, okay, so what? And then we'll dig into what went wrong, and again it'll be a case of not who messed up or who do we blame, but what happened, what caused
what
the
are the
problem?
Conditions in the context.
What were the conditions, what set us up to come so close to failure? And it happens time and time again that you will the chain of events that often goes in multiple different directions, it can be really hard to unpick, but there are so many things to dig into. But it's all about something or a what that happened, some processes, some cultural norms that set us up that way, rather than focusing on individual failures, because it just doesn't help. People get pissed off, they get defensive, and learning just breaks down.
No, it's cool. And one of the bits that, so I made I'm out in Vancouver at the moment, and I've just put a LinkedIn post about capacity and resilience. And it's like, I was talking about running around a local peninsula, and I needed to get back for a meeting at 8 o'clock. I was going to meet my buddy that I'm co-teaching with, and I planned a 12K run, get back in time, planned for 7:30. It's fine. Left at 6:30. I could do that. And as I, in fact, left a little bit earlier than that. And as I was running around, this beautiful sunrise, taking photos, and that's eating into the margins that I've got. And I get round to the other side of the headland and I'm like, yeah, I'm probably not going to be able to do my whole route. But I already know that there are tracks across the headland through the forest that I hadn't planned on taking. But I knew roughly what my running pace was. I knew what my constraints were. And I knew how long it was going to take me to cool down and shower and be ready. And mm-hmm. and so I finished at 7:40, shower change, downstairs, 8 o'clock, bang on the button. But it's that bit of actually the capacity of what we are trying to do in your space, the aviation space. The capacity is all about building mental models, the ability to think quickly, mm-hmm. the ability to project what's going on. In diving, that capacity is, how long is my gas going to last at this depth? If I work harder, is that going to go up? Is the current, if that increases, does that mean my consumption rate goes up? If my buddy's got leaking gas, or if, you know, it's understanding what the future looks like. And as we mm-hmm. start to get more and more pressured, those margins get eroded. And it's only when those margins are eroded, that capacity is exceeded, we have the accident. But that doesn't tell us how close those margins are. And that's the really important piece when we're talking about debriefs is, why were we successful, i.e. we didn't have a bad outcome? Was it luck or was it skill? And could we identify that? And then how do we spot that going forward? So one of the bits that I found in the online space from a personal point of view, and I know from yours, is when we post a story and we talk about things that are happening and how do we try and generate those conversations, the stories disappear down different avenues. And that's fine, because that's what conversations do.
Yep.
My sort of two bits that I get is, one is we now lose control of the narrative and we have an idea. And the other bit is sometimes those conversations are derailed by people we may not necessarily respect or trust. Right. And they don't necessarily understand how and why the decisions we make. So those two bits there is, you know, your experience of having conversations derailed and how does it make you feel? And then also, what's it like when somebody's critiquing you? It's like, you just don't understand how and why people behave the way they do. And that's, what's what we try and do in terms of an education process. But it could be hard when you're on the other side. So, So what's your experience of that?
Well, my experience of being on the receiving end of critique is, it's not very nice. I used a human diver platform to demonstrate vulnerability. We have to practice what we preach. So I've shared a few stories over the last few months about not necessarily near misses, but things that I've reflected on and realized I could have done better, or my team could have done better, and various aspects why. Somewhat disappointingly, you'll often find that people will just start throwing these metaphorical rocks at you from behind Facebook and calling you rude names. Like that has happened to me on some of the stories, and you just sort of think, oh, it's not very nice. And we naturally tend to focus on the negatives. So you might have, let's call it 20 comments, and 18 of them will be positive. People saying, thanks for sharing, really good learning experience. Something similar happened to me once. And then you've just got these two comments from people who've got no idea who they are potentially. And they
don't know you either in your actions either. So
they don't know you. They don't necessarily have the whole full picture. They've just got your version of events, and they call you names and they say you were stupid and you should have done something differently. Not helpful. In terms of dealing with that, I think the important thing is to try and keep, let's call it, the moral high ground, which can be a challenge, but it's really important. There's a concept called the Batari box, I think it is, where
you wrote a blog about that, which is really good. We'll put it in the show notes.
It's a great concept. You know, your actions affect somebody's behavior, affects their actions, affects their behavior, and round and round. And you see it all the time on Facebook, where if somebody escalates the tone, for whatever reason, then you will naturally feel defensive. You will escalate the tone back, and you'll call them names, and they'll call you more names, and all of a sudden, you just hate each other, and you get banned from Facebook. So, the best approach is to it's a challenge, but the best approach is to just try and take that step back, ask them what makes them think that, and again, you have to use that right language. You have to use the appropriate language. You can't sort of say, "Why do you think that?" It's what makes you think that. What makes you say that? Try and put it on something rather than someone, and just try and get the conversation going. And it's not going to work every time. I appreciate that social media isn't a perfect platform, and humans are humans, but I find that's probably the start, just to try and take things back to a normal level of conversation, try and calm things down, and that will hopefully get a calm response in return. And normally you might have to agree to disagree, but I've generally found most conversations will go in a pragmatic fashion if I adopt that approach. That tends to work.
And I think what you've just said there is something that I try and practice. And there's something, there was a post recently. It's like, well, sometimes you just got to tell people they're stupid. And it's like, and the bit then is that probably won't land with that person anyway, and you will escalate the process. Yeah. But more importantly, from a role model and a leadership position, is other people, many more people, will read your adversarial approach, your attacking position on that idiot, that stupid person that's there. And so actually, that might be one person that you're trying to put back in their box. You've now impacted 10, 50, 100, 250 people. Whereas actually, from that moral high ground point of view, that reinforces that things are relatively safe as best we can. It doesn't help us, you know, our own internal bit. We sit there going, oh, this is what I believe, and you're basically stabbing me in the heart because it's those values that are there. But if we can ask those curious questions about the context, what are the conditions, what are the behaviours, then we can hopefully start to shift the language. And I think actually, you know, the Human Factors and Diving Facebook group we've got is pretty mature, that we as the sort of the instructor base don't need to do much in terms of moderation or commenting. The community is pretty good at self-policing. Yep. When those adversarial comments come in, the community, because we have created that sort of culture that's in there, will start to defend those involved.
No, and on that as well, I mean, that's a really good point, because several of the stories that I've put in recently, I'll have people who I know, who are people I dive with, people who, you know, we trust each other, and they'll add to the comments, and they will mediate on my behalf, as it were. I don't have to step in and defend myself. They will step in and say, hey, Joe, you know, appreciate the dialogue, but you're really not helping. And I know Mike, I trust Mike. He's a competent diver. He believes in, you know, he educates for the human diver. I think his story is great. So it's important that we share this stuff. Sometimes their language perhaps isn't perfect, but it's a good, once you've kind of got the masses on your side, it tends to help. Something else as well, which I think is really worth bearing in mind, is kind of anchoring bias on the line of the comments. So if you have a story shared, and let's say the first comment is a laudatory one saying, thanks for sharing, brilliant, this something similar happened to me, it's more likely that follow-on comments will follow the same thread. You might see a let's call it an anti-vax post, and you'll have 100 comments by the time you see it, and they're all saying, yeah, you know, the government needs to be held to account.
Pylons,
yeah, exactly. All these people just jumping on the bandwagon saying how evil, you know, the corporate world is or whatever. And if you're that one person that thinks, actually, I'm not so sure, you're far less likely to actually wade in and say, well, this is my opinion. I think you're all wrong. And therefore, it's less likely that you have to experience that those negative behaviours, I suppose.
Yeah. And I think that the way that social media works doesn't benefit what we try to do in the Human Diver, because we're trying to provide good stories, you know, it's developmental stories, but that doesn't satiate the algorithm, which is about bad news, it's about fear, it's about blame, it's the negative side. And you say, oh. And so I get that some people, and it goes against our sort of values, they end up using the clickbaiting of, you know, reactions about divers being stupid. And it's like, oh, and I get why they do it, because they've got to try and get there. But that doesn't help the learning.
Nope.
Because that's the frame straight away. There's another bit that I sort of dig into, and I think in the online space, in if we're doing face-to-face, mm-hmm. and having a synchronous dialogue like this, where 1-1-1-1, then actually it's much easier to get that truth out. But in the online space, we could have long delays, and we lose track. But we also, in a face-to-face environment, if we haven't got an idea about how we communicate, you might want to listen to answer or challenge or interrupt me straight away. And I can pick that up in terms of verbal, non-verbal communications. Mm-hmm. In the online space, I think people read to answer as opposed to read to respond or to understand in that space. So anything on that?
I think it's like a lot of things to do with bias. It's something to talk about in forums like this and raise awareness that this is how people naturally behave. And therefore, if people have observed that that's how they naturally are inclined to react, i.e. listening to answer rather than listening to respond, then they might go, oh, I don't want to be one of those people that listens to answer. I need to actually think about what Gareth and Mike were talking about on that podcast I listened to the other day. That's kind of it's about the education side of it, because it is just human nature to do that. The mediation side of it can kind of help with a bit of additional help from other people perhaps as well. But I guess the education is the start, getting people to think about these things, have a bit of awareness, and then almost it's like in a face-to-face environment, I would say, rather than listening to respond, somebody says something, take a deep breath is probably a good initial, like, this is your instant reaction. Take a deep breath, try and paraphrase back what they've said to you to show that you've understood, and that kind of helps cement it in your brain as well. Maybe take another deep breath and then add your thoughts, and you can kind of do that, let's call it metaphorically, online as well. Read what somebody said, take a deep breath rather than starting typing, maybe start typing. Maybe have a look at, get somebody else to do something. What you could do in this day and age as well is actually use AI to help your response. And you can say to, you can type out a, you can type in a certain comment, or you can copy and paste a story, and then you can say, right, ChatGPT, whatever, this is what I think. However, I don't want to come across as adversarial. I want to come across as constructive. Can you help me frame this in the right way? AI will give you a response. Yeah. You might like it, you might not, but actually, you know, AI's got an awful, the most large language models, there's a hell of a lot of information out there. That's actually a pretty good idea, I think, to help you get the message across that you want in an appropriate fashion.
Absolutely. And, you know, I know we do in the team, we'll bounce ideas off. I've got this response. Can you just look at it for me? And I know that I've done that in terms of responses to organizations, mm-hmm. where I've gone off and gone, right, this is it.
Yeah.
And it's that bit of, no. I'm not going to hit send because I recognize that that's pretty emotive language.
Yeah.
And as a consequence, I need to have somebody who can temper it. And AI becomes that sort of self-checking peer. Mm-hmm. And that brings me on to the sort of the bit around the education piece. And it's not just about understanding human error, the sort of slips, laps, and mistakes and adaptations, violations that are there, yeah. how and why people behave the way they do. But it's about building the vocabulary and understanding the context and the power of words. And we started right at the start of focusing on the action or something, not someone, which is an educational process. And we've got to see the value in that, because that can really help the learning when people reframe it and go, ah, I wouldn't make his mistake, but I might encounter those conditions.
Yep.
And so it's that bit of, okay, so we can't change how we react and respond. We can try and sort of temper some of that.
Correct.
But if I know that I'm going to be, like, going back to the story this morning about capacity and the how I, the running story, how I framed that from a learning point of view, is that when we reduce those margins on, say, a dive, if you're at a dive center and we've got lots of people coming in, somebody's ill, and we start to compress time, we reduce that capacity. Now people start to get stressed. They start to get worried. And that means that their working capacity, their the working mental capacity that's there, the working memory is reduced, and they're more likely to forget something. And then when they forget something, they pick it up, you know, hopefully before it's catastrophic, and that triggers more stress. So we end up with that spiral. So it's actually understanding, build capacity, understand the conditions and the context, and help us understand that rather than take things right through to the wire. And that, I suppose, brings me on to probably one of my final bits. We'll see where the conversation goes. And that's really what this point is, that in the main, those online dialogues are really useful, because
I think so.
As we've just had, we trigger ideas and thoughts. There is no way that as part of a narrative, a report about an event, we would capture everything. And we wouldn't be able to identify what other people have, but they might say something and you go, oh yeah. And it might be somebody else who was on that dive and they go, oh yeah, this is what I saw. This is what, oh really? I didn't get that. And in the you know, the verbal environment, face-to-face environment, that's easier. In the online space, it's much harder, but those secondary and tertiary stories are really useful. So have you got any examples of where your stories just in general or in the diving space have triggered other ideas and other learning points?
There's probably countless examples. I guess the one that happened recently was to do with how I'd got to the end of a dive with I was on my rebreather. The diver I was with was diving a twin set. And everything felt okay from my point of view. Computer was normal. Dive time was as planned. And we got back to the anchor line, back up to the boat. And as we get to 6 meters, I'm basically just waiting to do a safety stop because I want a rebreather. And that kind of depth is absolutely perfect for what I was doing. But then my twin set buddy, who was on air, then says he's got like 18 minutes of decompression. And it's like, what, you know, what happened there? And then with hindsight, you can pick it all apart and you can see where things got missed during the dive and we didn't consider things during the plan. And it's easy to kind of come up with some debrief points. And I guess in the dialogue afterwards, this is one of the particular stories, unfortunately, where you do get the armchair warriors throwing rocks at you, which is a bit frustrating. But again, it's part of what this is all about so far in the culture we live in. But there were certainly a few little things that just came out of the discussion that I think were quite useful. That was kind of a personal one that happened to me. An interesting one, which is to do with the story that somebody else posted, which I thought was really quite good. But again, that got attention from other people, and they picked on bits of information that were interpreted differently to how it was intended by the author, based on, you know, me talking to the author directly, and their response came across, you know, not how they intended because of just the way that language was used. And you kind of have these, you've got the conversation between, let's call it the post writer, the author and the commenter, and they're kind of doing this, but then you talk to them both offline and you kind of go, ah, right, now I can sort of see how it all works. Now getting the three people in a room discussing it openly, you know, is a challenge, but at least you can kind of join the dots and go, oh, okay, and then offer some hopefully useful advice on how they can avoid those sort of things in future. But it's quite common for people to, you know, cherry pick a particular phrase, what it means to them, and instantly jump on the author and say, well, that's just stupid. That's not part of being a, you know, a human factors advocate. You obviously don't know what you're talking about. And it's like, well, hang on, rather than just sort of making those assumptions about what you think they meant, you could just say, can you go into more detail about what you meant?
Yeah.
And then, like I say, behind the scenes, I found that people have, guess what, meant something else. But just the way that it was phrased, because of cultural norms and our biases, it gets interpreted in a way that isn't ideal. So there's plenty of stuff that I've seen out there, both in my own stories and other stories. And a lot of it comes back to having that awareness from an education point of view that we are all subject to bias. And when you see stuff like the fundamental attribution bias that you talked about, I wouldn't make that mistake or wouldn't make your mistake. Try and take that deep breath. Have a listen, have a think metaphorically if you're reading something, and then ask questions back to get more knowledge rather than filling in the blanks with your own experience, which isn't really much use a lot of the time.
No, it's cool. And so thank you for that. And that triggered a thought just now of a couple of bits that went into my master's research, which was about the difference between a synthesized story, which you would normally get in like a safe built. This was a construction accident report, and the safety officer had written that report, and it was basically bringing together witness statements and what happened, and they basically produced one story through the lens of the safety officer, the health and safety officer that was on site. And the research piece was basically to take this synthesized story and then the individual statements and then present them to individuals as basically what did they perceive. So when you had a simple synthesized linear first story, people were very more, you know, much more judgmental. They would use these counterfactuals, should have, could have, would have, failed to, lack of leadership, lack of situation awareness, those sorts of things. And it was very much a punitive, blame type focus. But then when you take a multi-actor narrative and a multi-actor timeline, and then you start to see how and why different stakeholders, different players are behaving and how it made sense to them to do what they did, then the language becomes much more around a just culture and sense-making and local rationality. And you sit there and go, well, that person knew that, but that person didn't know that. Now, when we look at the first report, we jump to those conclusions. And it's a really powerful tool that I've used in both training and my master's and some other research, where you tell a very simple narrative, very judgmental linear narrative, and people go, and they go, right, let's look at the other story. And it's like, and people get quite deflated because they go, oh, but then they have a little bit more sympathy.
Yeah.
And there's less judgment. And I think that's a really powerful way we can really help in the diving industry is get multiple actors to tell their perspectives. Because when we hear something or read something, we make an assumption about what others in the activity knew or did or didn't do as the such. But
yes,
actually, we hear their first. And I had somebody who's on the current class, the current masterclass.
Yeah.
They provided a brilliant experience where they were going through an incident report. There was a group, it was a committee for this team that was operating, and they were going through the incident reports at the sort of leadership level to discuss this. And this was a relatively comprehensive report that had been submitted, and they were going through it, and the committee were going, and picking holes in it. And it's like, why didn't they do that? And this is it. And they're just like going, and the person who was leading the sort of discussion said, do you want to speak to the person who's involved? And it was like, yeah. And they went, he's sitting over there. And it was like, and it was a really interesting piece. So that person who wrote the report, in their best view, they thought they'd written a really good report.
Yeah.
They thought they'd added everything that was needed to help other people learn. And then they were listening to this conversation going, oh, but it's obvious because this is what I did. It's like, it's obvious because it's in there, but it's not written down. And I think that's another powerful piece is that we, when we write those stories with the best intent, we think we're getting something across there, but we cannot get everything. We can think more than we can say, and we can say more than we can write down. And when we write stuff down, we make assumptions what others know. So it's a really interesting piece.
I witnessed something personally just like that in, again, another story I shared a couple of months ago where I was actually, to be honest, I think I was making more out of the incident to try and give some life to the story and the concept I was trying to get across rather than actually talking about a really serious mishap. But it was purely to do with a slight miscommunication, which I think I could have done better with hindsight, which was the whole point of the story and the post and the reflection. But I did kind of, I guess, exaggerate some of the language and the conversation between me and the junior dive master in question. But people, yeah, jumped on this bandwagon and were just like, "My God, you sound like a complete like asshole. What is wrong with you? Yeah. Why do you talk to people like that?" And it's like, I think you've missed the point. And you try and again reframe it by saying, no, you've misinterpreted what I said there. It was actually more like this. And they're going, no, I've got confirmation bias now. I've read this. I've cherry-picked the bits in your story that I want to. You're still an asshole. You're like, right, okay, well, sooner or later, you have to just kind of give up. But
move on, and hopefully it's
a fact of life.
And anything else that you would add to this in terms of the learning? You know, it's not easy. People go, "Oh, can't we just report these things?" And it's like, well, what are you trying to do? Are you trying to count numbers? So in which case, it could be just a really simple event. But if you want to create learning, learning is an iterative, emergent process. Mm-hmm. And the online space isn't really, written space isn't really conducive to that. But it has got some opportunities.
Yeah, as you say, it's not perfect because of a lot of things we've just talked about for the last half an hour. I think the key thing to do, and let's talk about incident reporting system to start with, is it would be great if diving incident reporting systems had the ability to actually make them two-way. Like at the moment, for lots of reasons, resources, constraints, culture, sheer volume of material, they tend to be one-way. Here's your incident report, diver, fill that in. Post it to Paddy, Dan, wherever. BSAC, Nawi, whatever, and it'll just get dealt with. And it's like, okay, fine. And sure enough, people aren't trained to fill in incident reports properly, because why would they be unless they're from a high-risk industry like aviation or medicine or nuclear or whatever? And therefore, when the incident report gets in the hand of the incident report collator, they're just like, interesting. This person ran out of gas. They lesson to everybody, don't run out of gas.
Don't run out of gas, yeah.
Great. Really not very helpful. And I'm sure we know plenty of incident report summaries which really do that kind of thing, and it's just arguably a bit of a waste of time. Now, in the online space, or perhaps if YouTube space, Facebook, written, video, whatever, once you've finished your story, almost have a copy and paste paragraph along the lines of, I know I don't have all the answers. None of us are as smart as all of us. What do other people think? What other lessons would people take away from this story? And that kind of shows that you've got that level of humility, vulnerability. You know you're not perfect. You know that there are things in there that other people might pick up on. And therefore, you invite that conversation, that dialogue to try and get things going. Yes, you might. There is a risk you open yourself up to people calling you an idiot. I think that by doing what the human diver does in terms of our education material, our blogs, podcasts like this, the posts that we put on the various Facebook groups, the culture is changing and people are more and more likely to respond in the way that we want or the way that we need, rather, for learning to occur. So I think you have to open yourself up. You don't have all the answers. What do other people think? And gradually it will become the norm that people will reply in a constructive fashion, framing the language in the right way, potentially using AI to adjust their initial response to try and make it more digestible. And we'll get there. We'll get there more and more normally as we go on.
Brilliant. No, it's a big education piece. And to that end, thank you for the contributions, Mike, and the dialogue we've just had. We're not a DEMA. This video will probably go out in the next few days. So DEMA ends on the 14th, 15th of November. 14th of November. And this will be afterwards. But we're not there, but we still provide that education capability. So there's the podcast version of The Human Diver, a concise version of each of the chapters. And the biggie for 2026 is the Human Factors in Diving Conference that's going to take place on the island of Vis in Croatia from the 30th of May through to the 6th of June. And that is about bringing people who want to grow, to learn, to dive, the applied skills programs. We're going to have speakers that are there. And it's about growing the knowledge, growing the movement that's out there. And that's what we do. So if people have got comments about this video, please leave something behind in the show notes below, comments below. Otherwise, come and join us in the Human Factors and Diving Facebook group. It's probably one of the mature, open areas on Facebook. There are many closed groups where they trust each other, but we're trying to grow much wider than that. So, Mike, thank you very much for your time, and we'll catch you soon.
It's been good. Thanks, Gareth.